All right, how's everybody doing? Welcome to Tuesday. Yes, episode 63 of Chicago Music Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com, and of course, the director of entertainment and programming at the soon-to-be-opening Epiphany Center for the Arts. We're going to be opening up in September. Lots to come. We'll be announcing a jazz, blues, rock, Latin, hip-hop, house music series, all at the Epiphany Center for the Arts, 201 South Ashland Avenue. Everything's going to be obviously previewed on this show as we get closer to the announcement date and get tickets going on that. But if you want to hear more and learn more about the Epiphany Center for the Arts, visit epiphanyshy.com. All right. So before we get into it, again, the clubs are starting to open up, and there are also virtual jazz camps starting to open up. Greenmill and Andy's, by the way, are opening up. Heard from Winters. They are going to do a live stream at some point, and then I think this weekend. So I'm going to get more information from Scott over at Winters. So we'll announce that, obviously. And then I just got information about the Chicago Jazz Philharmonic. They're going to be doing a virtual jazz camp. They've got a lot of stuff going on. They've got some other virtual things planned. All of that information, along with the Jazz Institute, of course, you heard from Heather and Darius last week. So the Jazz Institute of Chicago, they've got a virtual camp coming up in July as well. Midwest Young Artists is doing a virtual camp coming up very soon. Birch Creek Summer Jazz Camp is doing a virtual camp. Shell Lake is doing a virtual jazz camp, and lots of other information. So check everything out. That all that information, because it pertains to jazz, is on chicagojazz.com. Now, if you want to watch some of the past issues, past episodes, and also hear some of the past podcasts, visit chicagomusicrevealed.com. And if you are watching this on another platform, we are streaming live from the Chicago Jazz Magazine Facebook page. So we would love to get a comment from you. Send us over. If you're hearing us good, if you can hear us, like us, give us a thumbs up, share this out, get the ball rolling. We've got a lot of viewers coming in right now, which is exciting. So I'm not going to continue to talk. I got all my plugs out of the way. It is going to be a pleasure. We're going to have a great talk today. We've got Charles Pillow on. He has got a brand new recording called Chamber Jazz. Charles, how are you? It's great to have you joining us today for a few minutes.
Good, Mike. How are you? I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm doing good. We are making it through this incredible time that none of us have ever lived through before, as we all know. And wondering how you're doing, because you're also a professor at Eastman. And before we get into the new recording, Chamber Jazz, which of course is available at charlespillow.com, we're going to talk all about this. You're also a professor, so I'm assuming that you probably had to close out the year probably doing the Zoom thing, as most of the universities and high schools had to do.
That's correct. Yeah, we did 7 weeks of online teaching, and we did the best we could. The students were very adaptable, and we delivered.
There you are.
You know, I think we were able to get about 70% of their needs. You know, you couldn't really play live very well together. So that was frustrating for everybody. But I think we got through it okay. And we developed maybe lateral ways of dealing with the subject matter.
Well, and you know, I find it interesting, and you know, I'd love to get your take, since I mean, you've played with everybody. In addition to your own music, you're on over 100 recordings, so you've toured the world, played with a lot of different artists, a lot of different musicians throughout the entire world. But this was kind of that little time, right? I mean, for schools and for musicians, we had a little pause, and people actually had to delve into this technology and figure out ways to maneuver in the technology that I don't think anybody ever had time to or had really the wanting to, in order to make something work, in order to connect with people, and in your case, also finish out an entire semester at Eastman. So, I mean, did you find that as the you know, 7 weeks went on, everybody got a little bit more adept? Did you find little workarounds with the technology to be able to get as much to the students as possible?
Workarounds and somewhat, you know, yeah. A lot of the other professionals were using a cappella, you know, writing tracks for their students, which I did a little bit of, but I didn't delve deeply into it. I think we just sort of talked about other things. We got deeper into transcribing, analyzing jazz solos, that type of thing. So the playing, you know, I feel like there's going to be a lot of solo projects coming out this year.
Well, that's a great transition to lead into your Charles Pillow Ensemble and the new recording Chamber Jazz that just came out in February. Of course, it's available at charlespillow.com, because this recording is anything but a solo recording. I mean, the amount of people that you have in the ensemble, and to me, it's always interesting. You know, it's sometimes when you add in strings and you add in, I mean, you have trombone, you have tuba, you have French horn, you have, you know, a rhythm section, you have everything in there. Sometimes it either works or it doesn't work. And I think it's the approach that people take with it. Now, your approach with this was really interesting arrangements. And it seemed like everything was really arranged out, and then there was improvisation spiced in around it. Was that the concept behind it? I mean, when you were writing this, because it seems like a big undertaking to write all of this and arrange all of this music.
Well, the previous project I had done was a sort of a standard big band. Mm-hmm. And like we said earlier, I wanted to try just to evolve that process with different instrumentation. So I was studying a lot of music that I always have loved, Debussy and Ravel, French composers. There's always been a link to jazz. I mean, Satie was a improviser, from what I understand, what I've read about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, trying to sort of fuse those elements of that music with improvisation. I don't know, it seemed like it sort of fits hand in glove, you know, those two elements. I hope it works. You know, I'm trying to make it work, you know. So.
Well, no, it was a really interesting listen. And I think it's one of those recordings that you need to sit and you need to consume and digest a little bit. There's so many textures, so many layers that are happening on the different tunes, the different compositions. So I'm always curious when I'm talking to a composer, arranger like yourself, who's done so much, if you come up with a jazz tune, AABA, you're writing the tune, you come up with a melody, you can harmonize it, you put the chords in. I mean, I understand that concept. It's still a difficult proposition. But I mean, for something like this, how do you sit down and say, okay, I'm going to start off with this theme? I mean, what's the concept just to get things started with this type of a project?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I approached it like a big band, really. You know, I have to say one thing. A couple of years ago at Eastman, I was lucky enough to do some of the Charlie Parker with strings.
Oh, and
those things are so fantastic, so beautifully done. I thought, you know, I got to do some more of this. Mm-hmm. I didn't really think I would end up writing it, but I did. So, you know, it kind of evolved that way. I just love the feeling of that sound, of that group. So anyway, back to your question, it's like, you know, we did a concert of this music at Eastman before I sort of finished writing it. And I'll never forget, we were up on stage playing it for the first time, and there was sort of this shout chorus of sorts, if you can call it that, with strings sort of playing the melody and the brass interjecting. And after it was over, I thought, wow, it kind of worked, you know. I mean, I really didn't know. You know, I mean, so you don't really know what's going to happen, you know. So, which is great. Not that it was any, you know. I mean, it pleased me that it was
right, yeah,
acceptable, you know.
Right. Well, it's got to be kind of nice, because I mean, at Eastman, you're also able to take some of these things in and try them out with the students. And see what happens. Is that one of the part of the process? Like, hey, you know what? Let's read this thing down and see what this sounds like, certain aspects of it, when you're doing arrangements and compositions.
Yes, yeah, certainly. There's a wealth of talent up there. Yeah. And it's good for them. It's good for the students to be put in a situation where they're a little uncomfortable, you know, too. So, yes, it's a good thing all around.
So I want to remind everybody, you're watching Chicago Music Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com, and we're talking to Charles Pillow, charlespillow.com, in order to go check out this recording. I mean, we're not going to do it justice talking about it, so you need to head over, click on the link that we're going to put in below so that you can go check it out. But I mean, so you're writing all of this, and then the pandemic happened. So it came out February 21st. I'm assuming, have you performed this live yet?
Not in this setting, no.
Okay. Because this seems like something, to me, it's a cross between classical, jazz. Where do you see it fitting? What genre is it? I mean, there's elements of everything in there.
Well, yeah, thanks. Thanks for saying that. There's clubs all over that, you know, I did a project with the great trumpet player Tom Harrell, that was actually sort of similar, less players, but it was a lot of Ravel, French music. And, you know, I was hoping that, I'm still hoping, that there will be some venues. The Jazz Gallery in New York, Jazz at Lincoln Center does things like this. We did the Big Bear last August. So I'm hoping that they will, you know, once things start rolling again, there'll be some interest.
Yeah.
And if it's not, you know, you move on. You just keep the next project coming, you know?
Well, when I'm always curious when I'm talking to somebody that's composing and arranging something and then they're playing on it. When you put this, I mean, the amount of hours, the amount of time it must have taken to put this recording together and just get the music together is one thing, but then when you go in to record it and you sit down, do you have to like separate yourself from the creative process that you did when you were arranging and composing and now you're playing? So now you're like, okay, wait a minute, I'm not going to change stuff a million times here, I'm sitting here and I'm now the player. Or you approach it differently, maybe you are making changes, maybe you are kind of really integral into it. I would find it being difficult to have to do that because you'd be so close to it that it'd be tough to now put that aside. Now you're going to improvise and you're going to play on this.
Well, it's a disaster in the studio. It really is. And that's because you can't really hear a thing. You know, you're trying to get the headphone mix right. People are asking you a million questions.
Yeah,
Is this an F sharp or an F natural? You're looking at the score. I mean, it was just a disaster. But luckily, I have a friend, Pete McGinnis, who is a great writer. He was in the booth. And that's why when you do something like that, you have to have help. You know, you have to have somebody in the booth to sort of just decipher. And still, it's kind of a nightmare. But then, you know, you get the tapes back you get to listen back a couple months later. And you think, okay, all right, it's not as bad as I thought it was. You know?
Well, and that's one of those keys, because I've talked to different musicians whether they're a producer or whether they're just there as another set of ears and eyes kind of monitoring what's going on from the booth, it seems like it's an essential part of a project like this. Because as I've talked to different musicians that have done this, the ones that have had that said that they could not do it without a second set of eyes and ears that they completely trusted, because if they're going to play on it and they have all this together, it would be impossible.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at it, most of the folks that I've done records with, John Fedchak, Maria Schneider, they have help. They have help in the booth, you know. Mm-hmm. But that being said, you know, the more experience you have doing that, being the leader of a large ensemble, you get better at it. You learn to relax and hear things much quicker and with much more detail. So just like anything else, you know, it's like your first gig, you're nervous, you know, but you just develop a sense about it. So I'm relatively new to this, so it's still a big learning curve, but yeah, I'm taking it one step at a time.
Well, and I'm sure, you know, you're setting a great example for any of the students that you're teaching too, because I mean, you're going all in on this and you're putting out recordings, and this is your eighth solo recording, but you've been on over 100 other recordings, reading over your bio, and we could talk all about everything you have done for the next 3 hours. So we won't go down the wormhole and spend 3 hours talking about that, but I would be curious, because you've been on so many different recordings, what have you taken away from some of those experiences? Or is there an experience or two that you could share that you pulled, you said it just stuck with you and you've used that on some of your recordings, whether it's a technique, whether it's just the overall concept of how you walk in and deal with other musicians? I mean, were there some musicians that you've worked with that you just said, these guys are consummate professionals and this is how I want to operate in the studio?
Well, there's one recording of John Scofield that I was fortunate enough to be on. And it was, I think, about 5 or 6 horns. And his band, Steve Swallow, Bill Stewart. It's called Quiet. And he's playing acoustic. And he wrote all the charts. It's sort of Gil Evans-ish, mm-hmm. you know. And he told me he didn't really know what he was doing. He thought this would sound good. And he voiced it out himself. And it's really a beautiful project. But I'll never forget that. You know, he's playing acoustic. All his records have been him playing electric.
Yep.
And when it was on Verve, the record label called Verve, and mm-hmm. the head guy at Verve came into the studio. I'll never forget. He looked at John Scofield and saw an acoustic guitar, and he was in the booth, and I read his lips. He said, "He's playing acoustic?" He didn't even know, you know. I thought, oh, that's how the music business works, you know.
Well, it's first of all, that's a killer band that you just described there, and you got to be involved in that kind of a recording process. I mean, what's the back and forth when you're dealing with somebody like John Scofield, or even when you're doing recordings with, like you said, Tom Harrell or somebody like that? Are they looking for your input when you're in the horn section? Sometimes, like in the Scofield situation, I mean, those guys had been playing together already for years, and now they're putting the horn section together. Are you guys interacting and giving some feedback and adjusting things when you're in there? And because it's not necessarily a project where you're all working together on it, but how open are they?
Well, yeah, I try to just read the situation, and there was no, John Scofield did not want my input, you know, and that's fine with me. He had it together, but yeah, you sort of suss out the situation. If someone, you know, sort of asks, hey, how's that flute part? Is it okay? Is this going to work on this instrument? You know, but you know, it's all just trying to make the thing work, and get some people describe it as like a self-correcting horn section. So you go in there, you make it sound as good as you can with the least amount of friction. You know, mm-hmm. if you see a wrong note, just make it work. You know, and be a you know, a helper. You know what I mean?
Right.
And not slow the. And I certainly understand now where you don't want people asking questions. It really slows down the process. And then you get bogged. If this person asks a question and the next guy asks a question, next thing you know, you're an hour into it and you haven't played a note, mm-hmm. which is kind of par for the course anyway. But I think the real pros go in there and they make it work.
It's a real talent that you have to be able to walk in, look at the charts, and blend in for what the person that's bringing you in to do wants to have happen, obviously. So there's a whole process to do that and have it look completely natural, I would imagine, you know. But with something like what your brand new recording, Chamber Jazz, I mean, were there had to have been rehearsals or had to be something before you all walked into the studio, or wasn't there?
There actually wasn't. I learned, you know, Alan Ferber, the trombone player on there, mm-hmm. we were talking about this, and he said something to me once about along the lines of, you know, he tries to make he's a great writer, and he said something along the lines, and other arranging professionals talk about making the parts, you know, playable, where a good great players in New York can sit down and read it and make it work. It make the music come out without a whole lot of, you know, if it's too detailed, yes, you do have to rehearse sometimes. But many sometimes you put well-written things in front of great players, and it's going to work. So I'm learning all the time about how to make that process better in the studio, because it's always that way. It's always that way.
Mm-hmm. So I have to ask, because, you know, looking over everything, and I believe if I read it correctly, you know, flute and sax, I get no problem. Now, oboe, are you playing jazz oboe? I mean, is that something that you just took up because it was a woodwind instrument, or how did you end up with oboe?
Well, I started playing oboe in my sort of late college years, graduate school, you know, but for work, to work in New York. Mm-hmm. And that certainly helps in the Broadway show scene. And that's
sure.
Primarily what I have done for the last 30 years or so.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wanted to, and I tell my students this, that as a woodwind player, the other instruments can become like another voice for you. So yes, I do improvise a little bit on oboe. I used to do a little bit more. I haven't as much lately. And on this recording, I don't improvise on it, but there's mm-hmm. some sort of orchestral areas where I wanted to include, you know, I wanted that instrument. I said, well, I play it, so I can just throw that in there, you know. But the jazz stuff is on saxophone and mm-hmm. clarinet.
Right.
And I play a lot of flute on other projects, not this one so much. But the oboe was just, and the English horn, they're just colors mm-hmm. that, I mean, I've been fortunate to play a lot of, so that's why I put that in there. You know?
Well, I think what you just said, though, is really important for a lot of young musicians to hear, because it's similar to, you know, I mean, I play drums, but I play marimba, vibes, timpani, classical snare drum, all of that stuff. And back when I first was getting out of college, I could work in a lot of different areas because I knew that. And to your point, I mean, if you're a woodwind player, you should be able to play as many of those instruments as possible, obviously, because it's going to open up. But I love the fact that you brought up the fact that it also opened up your ears a little bit, because you have those different timbres, you have those other colors that you hear now when you're writing. I think that's really interesting. And, you know, like what we talked about right when we first started, you wrote this and you put this recording together because you wanted to further your compositional, you know, evolution. And by thinking that way and adding in these different colors, it must have really helped you just open up and expand your creativity when you sat down to write this stuff.
Well, I hope so. I tell my saxophone students about woodwind doubling that when you're practicing flute, you're going to want to hear great flute players. So when you hear great flute players, you're hearing music that you're not going to hear or not going to access playing saxophone. Although there have been transcriptions, you know, adapted to saxophone of Handel sonatas or Bach partitas. But, you know, to hear that music, to hear French music for flute and harp, as a saxophone player, you're not really going to hear that often. To hear an oboe, the Hindemith Oboe Sonata, you're never going to play that as a saxophone player.
Right.
But, you know, and it's just interesting how, you know, speaking of Hindemith, you hear like a couple of fourths. If you play some fourths, the interval, you know, on oboe,
sure.
It sounds like Hindemith. You play it on saxophone, it sounds like Wayne Shorter. I mean, you know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
In a very broad sense. But the same pitches in a different context on a different instrument sounds like a different thing. So I think I use the term cross-pollinization for my students. Like,
mm-hmm.
just let that music in, you know, you'll get something from it. Don't let it take away from your saxophone playing, but let it broaden your sort of your musical palette.
Yeah. No, I love it. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I think it's important for people to hear these different concepts and, you know, everything to open up your ears and open up your mind and open up your creativity so that you can push your improvisational or your compositional or arranging ability further. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. So the new recording, Chamber Jazz, charlespillow.com. I encourage everyone to go pick it up. You have to go listen to it. And this is one of those recordings that you need to do a deep dive, I think, because I listened to it, but I have a feeling it'll change. It'll sound way different if I shut the lights off and I have a glass of wine and I listen to it. And then I start to hear all the different levels of things, because, you know, when there's so many things going on, it's hard to intake it at once. So it's important for people to kind of consume it. And you're going to continue to hear different layers and different textures and different themes throughout it. So charlespillow.com. Now, before I let you go, we talked before we came on. One of our good friends here in Chicago, Mike Smith, and yourself were on the Sinatra Band. So I just have to say, what years were you on with Sinatra? Because I know everybody listening and watching this thing are fans of Sinatra, and a lot of them know Mike Smith. So I'd love to hear, what years were you guys playing? You played all the way up till the end, weren't you? That's what I think, what Mike was on, right?
Yeah, I started in 94.
Okay.
My first gig was, I forget where it was, but he fell down.
Oh.
We used to call him the old man.
Yeah.
He fainted on stage in my first gig while we were playing My Way. And I thought, that's it. So he got up. I think we were in maybe Richmond, Virginia, or somewhere like that. But it was that was an incredible gig. The music was, the charts were so beautiful. Nelson Riddle, Don Costa. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. So we had a great time with Smitty, and it was great.
Well, you know, that's one of those experiences that you were lucky to have, because, I mean, how many people could say that they had that experience being able to tour a little bit with him and play his charts with the man? You know, I mean, that's something that I'm sure it helped you down the road. You probably hear something, oh, yeah, okay, all right, because those kinds of experiences, usually nobody ever gets. So, I mean, I had to ask, because I'd be like, oh, man, I got to ask. So I love it. So, Charles, thanks so much for being on. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure meeting you. And, you know, if you are out and about and you start touring, you know, let us know if you're coming through Chicago. We'd love to preview something or feature something. So fingers crossed, maybe somebody here in Chicago brings you in and we could actually see you in person at some point.
Well, thank you, Mike, for having me.
Definitely. Thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too.
All right. Charles Pillow. You know, let me flip this back over here. Hang on. And I'm back. Okay. Now there's. Okay. I see. I knew it. You know, that's the problem with me running the board by myself. I have little snafus, but that's okay. That's all right. So it was a pleasure talking to him. I'm telling you, everybody should head over and check out the new recording, Chamber Jazz, charlespillow.com. It, just on first listen, it was really impressive. And I think you're going to get a lot out of it. If you like jazz, you like classical, you like orchestral music, this is a very interesting thing. It was a pleasure talking to Charles. I appreciate him jumping on. And, of course, we appreciate Lydia Liebman for sending everyone our way. And it is always a pleasure. Now, we had a guest scheduled for tomorrow, but we had an audible in the middle of the afternoon. So we are going to be announcing who that guest is a little bit later tonight on all of the social media platforms. Of course, if you like this show, please like it. Please share it. Please hit us up. And Thursday, programming alert, Thursday, Thaddeus Tukes is going to be on, and we're going to be previewing the recording he's dropping on Friday. I need to connect with Thaddeus so we can figure out how we're going to do that and have it work, but I know we're going to make it happen. So Thursday at 6 p.m., we're going to be previewing this new release that he has, and we kind of previewed it a couple of weeks ago, but we're going to catch up with him about his protest marching band and all of the great stuff he's got happening. So that's on Thursday. Tomorrow we're going to announce the guest, and then we'll be into the 4th of July weekend already. Holy cow, things are flying by. Can't believe it. But as I always say, I appreciate everyone watching, everyone listening, everyone sharing this out. If you like this, please like it, please share it, please hit us up, leave us a comment, leave us a DM. We're getting some great emails, but we love it when you comment on the live show as well. As I always say, tell your neighbors, tell your family, call the grandkids. Chicago Music Revealed right here, 6 p.m., Monday through Friday. We will see you back here tomorrow on the next broadcast.